Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for taking time on a Saturday to be with us, wherever you are in the world. And on behalf of everyone at Sutter Foundation, we wish you all a happy holidays and a very happy new year. So this is the last Conversation on Buddha Nature event in the year 2021. You can see all the past events on the Buddha Nature Resource website, and they are now available as both video or audio recordings that you can download and play anytime. So Conversations on Buddha Nature is a series of online interviews with Buddhist practitioners, scholars, and thinkers on the topic of Buddha Nature. For this event, Lopan Dr. Karma Punso will speak with longtime Buddhist translator and scholar Anne Bacardi. After taking refuge with Kalu Rinpoche in Kaguling, France in 1976, Anne began her Buddhist studies with Kempo Tsochum Gyamsa Rinpoche in 1977 and joined the work of the Marco Translation Institute in Kathmandu. She went on to become an interpreter for many Kagyu, Nyingma, and Gelugpa Lamas, including the Dalai Lama, for the next 35 years, mainly in Europe and Asia. During the 80s and 90s, she lived in Kathmandu, where she acted as teacher, secretary, and course coordinator at the Marpa Institute. Back in Europe, she became a Tibetan language teacher and associate professor at the University of Copenhagen for 18 years, as well as a research librarian and curator of the Tibetan collection at the Royal Library for a decade, which included work on the Twining Library Project with the National Library of Bhutan in Thimphu. She taught Buddhist studies at Naropa University as a visiting professor when I was there, actually, in 2004 and 5, and continued this work at the Buddhist University in Copenhagen. As you all know by now, Lopan Dr. Karma Punso is the recipient of Sagra Foundation's Writer in Digital Residence Grant for Buddhist Nature Studies and is our host for these conversations on Buddha Nature. Karma Punso is one of Bhutan's leading intellectuals and completed both monastic training in the Tibetan traditions as well as a doctorate at Oxford. He is the founder and president of the Loden Foundation in Bhutan, and his work is well known across the Himalayas and in Buddhist studies circles around the world. So without further ado, please welcome Anne Bacardi joining us from Denmark and Karma Punso joining us from Bhutan. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcus. And Kusazangpo, everyone from wherever you are attending this session. And Kusazangpo to Anne, after so many years, nice to see you. It's now well over a year that we have been getting out this these conversations with the hope of spreading the news of Buddha nature, the basic nature of all beings. And it's our hope that through this, we would be able to somehow overcome the challenges we face in the world today, challenges of low self-esteem, even self-hatred, egocentricity, rampant racial and gender discrimination, and so forth, by spreading this message of Buddha nature and positive thinking of compassionate engagement and spiritual openness. So it's such a great pleasure to have you, Anne, somebody who have been into Buddha nature study and practice since 1970s. That's quite a long time. So it's wonderful to get you here to share your knowledge, experience, wisdom. I think in spite of some personal health challenges you also have. So thank you for joining us. Before we begin, I think as usual, we'll probably spend a few moments thinking of here and now and cultivating bodhicitta to sort of put our state of mind in the right position. So if you can all spend a few moments to generate bodhicitta. Thank you. We often begin the session by asking our guests to share your own background, particularly how you encountered the Buddha nature teachings and from whom you got these teachings the first time, if you have any memories and the first time impressions you had. So if you can share a bit so the audience knows your background and from where you're approaching.
Thank you, Kamala, and thank you, Marcus, for hosting us, and thank you to Tatra for organizing these wonderful broadcasts on the nature of the mind, something that makes me very, very happy to see the website and the whole all the effort, which is something that, of course, as you understand, is something that has been a very important in my life. Ever since I met Tibetan Buddhism, I was 16 years old at the time that I came into contact with the Tibetan Buddhism in Copenhagen, Denmark. And at this time, the 16th Karmapa came with a large entourage of high Rinpoches and lamas. In fact, a whole bus full of lamas were traveling around Europe in 77 and visiting, spending 2 weeks in Denmark. And this is when I first met the 16th Karmapa. And he brought with him Jamgon Kongtrul Rinpoche, Tenka Rinpoche, Kenpo Tulsim Gyamso Rinpoche, and many other high lamas. So this was a fantastic time for us. The year before that, as you mentioned, Marcus, I met Carlo Rinpoche in Kerteminderne in France, where he came to give the initiations for the first 3 year retreat. At this time, I just turned 17 and I didn't know anything about Tibetan Buddhism. So it was all very mystical to me at the time, but it was enough for me to realize that this is the path that I wanted to follow. We were some at the time who had started to suspect that the world around us was a description that we had inherited from, to a large degree, from people around us. And we were young people who were looking for, you know, meaning of life. Mm-hmm. And also we were inspired by ideas that the world is whatever we perceive it to be. We were not really subscribing to very mainstream versions of reality, if you can say like that. We were some who were reading books like Carlos Castaneda, which showed how you can access other levels of reality. And he was, receiving some kind of training from a shaman who showed him how to stop the world, how to see, and how to, perform different things that actually seems now in retrospect to be very similar to some sort of yogic conduct. However, we were not, able to really follow up on this in any way that was very, we were looking for teachers basically. Mm-hmm. So when the Karmapa came with these realized masters who all had very overpowering presence of realization, when we entered into their presence, we were immediately hit by the fact that they had such a pure perception of the world. And they even had pure perceptions of us, which were even more surprising. So this was a very strong, we were able to meet somebody who was already resting in the nature of the mind and thereby embodying Buddha nature, if I may say it like that. Mm. So then this was enough for me to kind of stop any other education, and I started to study Tibetan because I wanted to learn where did this come from, because it was a very valid path. It was a very reasoned and structured path that was being presented to us of how we could perceive the purity around us and thereby transform, or, you know, as a way of transforming our own mind. It was, you know, it was shown to be a completely valid path that could be followed, and a stable path, as opposed to other ways of trying to access other realities which weren't very stable. So here was a very structured path that one could follow. So then the 16th Karmapa, he then entrusted the Kempo Tsultsim Gyamsa Rinpoche to educate translators for the purpose of, you know, spreading Buddhism in the Western countries. And so I was lucky enough to join this first course in 78, which took place in Dordogne in France. And here we started to study the first text that was studied was the Uttara Tantra Shastra. So that we had already heard from the teachings the Kempo gave when the Karmapa was there about the, you know, the cause is the Buddha nature, from Gampopa's Jewel Ornament of Liberation. So this became like the motivation for our whole spiritual path. It became this knowledge that you had a Buddha nature. And so then when we started to study it in the Uttara Tantra Shastra, this was actually very surprising that it was being taught to us who were like very much beginners. When you consider that the Uttara Tantra Shastra is mostly studied after like maybe 10 years of full-time studies in the traditional Shidras, the monastic universities in Tibet and the Himalayan region. So why did he teach that to us as complete beginners at this time? We were like struggling with just spelling our way through, you know, some of the highest teachings available. And this was a surprising choice. So I would like to return to this point. Why did he teach this to us as like total beginners?
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, it's amazing, of course, that you had these fantastic masters who you encountered, and then you even had the opportunity to study the ultimate continuum, Dzogchen Lama, with Kenjin Sutim Jatso. But it must be partly because the Kagyu tradition, as you pointed out through Gampopa's citation, know that they sort of, not only the Kagyu, in fact, even the Nyingma, they sort of take the ground, the Buddha nature, as the beginning, the basis from where the spiritual training has to begin. So that could be one reason why you are exposed to such an advanced topic quite early on. Do you think that the case? If you went to a Gelugpa master or some other Buddhist master, you would have probably got some other teachings to begin with.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah.
So for me, it was basically the first teaching that I kind of encountered.
And when you encountered such teachings, Buddha nature, the ultimate continuum, it presents a rather sort of absolutist approach to Buddhist teachings. Some people even allege that it is bringing the theory of self into Buddhism in some disguise. Did it sort of surprise you that a Buddhist system, which normally denies any sort of substantial existence, which denies the existence of self, and here you are beginning with this text and teaching that deals with something that's real?
Well, Kenpo Rinpoche never let us believe in a personal individual self. So for me, there was not really any doubt that there could be any kind of confusion about that point, even though, of course, the terminology that is being used it can, you know, I think if you had not been guided by the oral tradition, you may make some misunderstandings, even though they say it is a transcendental sort of self. So even in the vocabulary, there's I don't think, for me, it was never really an issue. And honestly, even if I might be jumping a little bit too far into any discussion about this, honestly, I feel that sometimes not attacks, but, you know, the polemics about this from the Tibetan side of it, I think sometimes that it is really based on a misunderstanding of what really is meant. Like when I see masters like the Maharshi and you know who represent the Indian tradition, I don't see any evidence of a personal self being really upfront anywhere. As it's like, so it's an interesting and very long discussion.
Now this actually brings us to also the main topic of today's conversation, the purpose of Buddha nature teachings. Now, I mean, we have two schools of thought, one saying Buddha nature is a provisional teaching with a specific purpose in mind that the Buddha delivered, and then these purposes are counted. Whereas others would argue, no, these are not just provisional teachings with a sort of temporary purpose, but they are the objective teachings. So can you discuss this further? You wanted to share a lot about the purpose and especially bring the purpose given in the classical texts to our sort of daily life, how to make it relevant. I mean, we have been talking about Buddha nature and its hopeful use in this world today, but we have not actually gone into any deep discussions about this purpose as presented in the classical text. So please share your take on the purpose.
Thank you, Karma. Yes, this is, I think that might be useful for all of us to remind ourselves of why these teachings were given. And the discussion about the provisional and definitive, I would rather rate a little bit with that. So according to the text itself, there are five faults that, you know, that can hinder our progress. And the first fault is really depression or, you know, low self-esteem, as you say. It's a way of thinking that, you know, I'm not able to do this, you know, whatever it is, but especially I'm certainly not able to reach any state of enlightenment. So this is kind of it can be an obstacle to have this. The second fault or problem that is listed in the text itself is that our lack of respect for other beings. This can hinder our progress. That we hold on to that which has no true existence can hinder our progress. That we ignore the truth, that can hinder our progress. And that we have an inflated kind of feeling of self, this can also hinder our progress. So it is in order to overcome these five points that the Buddha nature teachings have been given, according to the Uttara Tantra Shastra. So what happens when we hear the teaching about Buddha nature, what happens to our mind? It uplifts the mind. It makes us joyful. It makes us enthusiastic. It really creates joy. And this joy then overpowers any feeling of, you know, low self-esteem and so forth. And I would like to, at this point, before going on to the others, I would like to mention that one commentary on the Uttara Tantra Shastra that I have been working with actually since, you know, for about 40 years now. I'm still finishing up with the Danish translation of it, is Jamgon Kondro Lodotai's commentary that is already available in English, as you know, called the Buddha nature or the changeless nature. This was actually translated by some of the earliest students of Kenpo Rinpoche in the West. That was Ken and Katja Holmes, who came out with their book, and so followed by Shempen and Rosie Fuchs and Michelle Martin worked on also bringing out that in English. So it exists in English. According to the Kondro Rinpoche, he then defines the joy as the joy of towards the hardships of the path. So hearing about the Buddha nature brings out a feeling of joy. And this joy is even used as a way of overcoming hardships on the path.
Mm.
So for me, this connects to the teachings on, you know, transforming suffering and happiness onto the path, Kido Glamkia, which is the very important practice of, like, you could say, alchemy, which is also, there's wonderful texts on this, for example, by the third Dudukchen in the Nyingma tradition. And also we see it in the yogic songs by Gyotsangpa and by Milarepa and so forth, where really hardships are taken as a way of transforming the mind. So I thought about this as I prepared for this talk. Then I thought about this, that, you know, the transcendence of suffering is not necessarily some far distant into the future supernatural event, but transcendence of suffering is a conscious decision that is made in every moment. And this is, the view then that you could start out with having this as a view. And this is really, as I said, exemplified in the, for example, yogi songs. And students of Kenpo Tsultu in Gyamso Rinpoche, we have been taught a lot of the yogi songs. And we use the yogi songs as a way of practicing, because they express, you know, the joy at the hardships. So whether we are a practitioner or not, I think overcoming hardships is something that's relevant for all of us. How do we deal with hardships? How do we deal with adversity? And as ordinary beings, we are really victims of circumstances. But a yogi is you know, somebody who takes charge of his mental states, and he transforms them. So this, I feel, is very relevant to the first point of why the Buddha nature is taught. It is to generate joy, and not just joy that, you know, we congratulate ourselves on having a Buddha nature and it's so great, but really joy in the face of hardships. And this, of course, relates also to, you know, modern day positive thinking in psychology. This is totally the same. And so this is the first point.
So before we move on to the second point, I just wanted to add a couple of things on this. One of the first texts that relates directly to this first point is Bodhicharya Avatara, where Shantideva talks about, you know, encouraging people on the path to awakening, saying even flies and insects have the Buddha potential. So as human beings, we ought to be able to reach awakening far more easily. And then the second point is, we these days talk a lot about resilience, isn't it? Personal resilience. And what you mentioned about sort of facing hardship with joy and overcoming them, turning them into your path or to your advantage. That is the kind of personal resilience that we need in most circumstances. I think a lot of people these days give in to low self-esteem and depression and even suicide because they don't have resilience. And I think you have really touched on that very effectively. So let's go then to the second point you want to discuss, the second point of not having contempt for other sentient beings.
Yeah, the second point then is that could hinder our progress and which the Buddha nature teachings then are given to overcome is, you know, that you might, you know, look down on other beings, and this complicates our relationship to others. But here, the text says we should look at others as if they were Buddhas. Basically, that's what the teaching says. Yes. So if we see other beings as Buddhas, of course, there will be absolutely no, it's kind of a pure vision, yeah? It's a pure vision. And if we act on that, we make everything so much easier for ourselves and others, because as I think was mentioned at the last, your last conversation with Lama Palden, you know, if you smile at people, then, you know, you have a, it will bring out the smile in the other person. And if you really relate to other people's Buddha nature, their pure nature, instead of to their disturbing emotions, it transforms, of course, the situation as well. So this is a given point that I'm sure everybody gets this point. So the second here is really to, that we, the first point was engendering joy. The second point is to engender respect to others.
But the text also give this connotation, doesn't it? At this Asanga's commentary, I think to an extent, that the first problem we have is of diffidence, not even generating bodhicitta or that courage to become a Buddha. And then if you overcome that diffidence and generate bodhicitta, you suddenly think, oh, I'm superior, I'm much better than those who haven't generated, and then start to have the second problem of the contempt, and that's, you need correct. To know, yeah, that's overcome great. The second problem.
Yes, because even as practitioners, you know, you may still feel, you know, you are superior to others, especially, you know, if you, yeah, you're saying like you are on the Mahayana path and others are not on the Mahayana path, or they are maybe not even a Buddhist, or they are following another religion, and all sorts of things of ways we can, you know, not respect others is really at stake here.
Yeah, and that leads on to the third problem. So if we
So then, as I said, the third problem is that we hold on to that which is not truly existent, and this refers, of course, to the disturbing emotions, all the veils that cover up the mind, without hearing the teachings on the Buddha nature, which tells us that they are not truly existent. This is what we got. We exaggerate the you know, the reality of our, both our own and also other people's, you know, disturbing emotions, our concepts, our, you know, our feelings. We take them all very serious. And this is, you know, according to the text, there's no basis for this. Everything dependent doesn't have a true existence. So these are actually empty of existence. So we are misguided here. We exaggerate something which does not have really a true true existence. And this is you know, the second problem. So hearing about the Buddha nature, we understand that these are merely passing things that you know, pass through our mind, and it's only our own fixation on them which makes, you know, solidifies them. And so this is kind of a relief. So after hearing these teachings from Kempo Rinpoche, and you know, you may be noticing what's going through your mind, and just the fact that you can, oh yeah, I can just let that go, because he's, I've just been told these are, they really have no true basis.
So when we have this fixation on the unreal, the adventitious things, then that leads us also away from the actual truth, the actual reality. That's the fourth problem, isn't it?
That's
not
right.
Appreciating the real Dharma.
Yeah. So when we fixate on the disturbing emotions, both our own and others, we become entangled in a really like worldwide web of confusion, mm-hmm. which is, you know, what is happening a lot these days. And of course, when we are so wrapped up in that, there's no opportunity. All our time is taken up with what fills the mind with, you know, and there's no opportunity to actually be with your Buddha nature. So as was said, the fourth problem is that we don't, that we ignore the true nature. We fail to experience it. And so hearing about the Buddha nature, hearing about the true nature of the mind and the qualities that it contains is really something that can make us very, can make us gain confidence that resting in the nature of the mind is not a blank state. A blank, empty vacuum. But this is the opportunity for letting the natural wisdom unfold. Mm. And this, of course, is hard when we are so preoccupied with the superficial layers of the mind. But as I said, if you meet masters, if you are lucky to meet someone who embody these qualities, then you really gain confidence that it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just mentioned wisdom, and I think Maitreya links wisdom as an antidote to this fourth problem, the fourth problem of integrating and deprecating real truth must be overcome through kind of a pristine wisdom experience.
And I would like to maybe add a little bit of interpretation to this fourth point of you know, experiencing the Buddha nature or the qualities of the true nature of the mind. Kempo Rinpoche again has, you know, equated often the what is called the rangrik or the, you know, self-reflexive awareness with the Buddha nature. Which is also based on the seventh Karmapa's pramana-based shintong, actually. I have been showing in some of my papers that the kind of shintong that the seventh Karmapa advocates is based on pramana. So here we are, you know, we can look at the very basic definitions of mind as something, you know, as a cognitive lucidity, as just a basic definition of mind. And this cognitive lucidity of the mind is actually that which enables the mind to experience itself. So most of the time, of course, our, you know, attention is focused outward, like 99% of the time, perhaps. So the rangrik is that part of the mind which is, you know, actually aware of itself. And this is something that happens even when the mind is, you know, defiled. It is still, the luminous quality of the mind is still there, even in the defiled, you know, when there are defiled events happening in the mind. But the rangrik then, according to Kempo Rinpoche, is that which then can experience our Buddha nature. So it's important, so I thought here, to mention that in the context of the fourth point.
Yeah, no, thank you for bringing that up. I think we had also some discussion on this in one of our other sessions, meet the author session with Professor Mathis, and we were talking about the distinctions between the sort of normal rangrik in the philosophical treatises, and then, or the Pramana treatises particularly, and then the Soso Rangrigpa Ishe, mm-hmm. which is, of course, in the Kagyu and Nyingma tradition, as you pointed out through Kempo's teachings, is, I think even the Soso Rangrigpa Ishe is Rangrig essentially. It is self-conscious. Whereas I think some other traditions may say, no, it's not the Rangrig that's normally discussed in the Pramana literature. It's just a consciousness or an awareness with no duality. So it's, I think, very good to point out that in some traditions, like I think Kaputsuti Myantso's tradition, even the awareness that's non-dual is actually self-conscious Rangrig that you find in the Pramana literature. Yes, but without any hypostasization.
Yes, I understand it. It's the basic definitions. There's a Rangrig or self-reflexive awareness of the relative states of the mind, which is, you know, just the way, the fact that we know what we're thinking or we know what we're feeling, which is with perhaps some duality there. But then the, as you say, the Soso Rangrig Ishe is when you experience the true nature of the mind, which is then, if I may add here to this, what the seventh Karmapa, he says, what the mind is empty of, you know, in the Shentong meaning of being empty, the nature of the mind being empty in the Shentong meaning, he means Shen is then the duality.
Duality.
So empty, Nitong. So it's empty of these two aspects, and that's the Shen. Of course, you can also say that the nature of the mind is Shen Tong in the sense of being empty of the adventitious stains per se, but also empty of this duality is his way of interpreting the nature of the mind as Shen Tong. Which relate to our fourth point here.
So now to dwell on our topic of the five purposes, the fifth one is coming back to this issue of ego, how sort of self-importance would actually become a problem for awakening.
Yes, and I should like to refer back to your conversation there with the Lama Paldin, where you were saying it's the flip side of the coin, that you have, you know, this low self-esteem, and then you have this necessity for an inflated kind of self, which is also listed then here as the fifth point. And this can be an obstacle or a hindrance on the path. So the teachings on Buddha nature then, helps us overcome any kind of, you know, exaggerated sense of self by again seeing that the Buddha nature that is in ourselves and in others is the same. Mentioned in Khomtru's commentary on this point is also great love, actually, he says, that we love ourselves and others equally. And again, I would like to refer back to the fact that it's also important with this self-love, you know, the genuine kind of kindness towards yourself in order to be able to, you know, be kind to others. So this is like the fifth point that shows why is the Buddha nature taught.
Yeah, I think we have the five problems, if I may summarize what you have shared, that we have to overcome. And then overcoming those five problems, you also get five merits or five benefits, isn't it, that Maitreya presents, saying that if you have this joy and enthusiasm in yourself, having overcome diffidence and low self-esteem, then that leads to respecting others as well. And then that leads to sort of not falling for unreal things, which will lead to recognizing the real truth. And that eventually leads to the great love, Jamchen, which is also in the root verse itself, the great sort of loving kindness that treats all sentient beings equally. Wonderful. Thank you for sharing these five purposes. For the audience, I think if you are keen on learning more about this, these are covered in the Ratnagotra Vibhaga or Mahayana Uttara Tantra, the ultimate continuum from chapter 1, from verse 157 to 167. And I think it's quite powerful. Although I do want to come back briefly on this purpose. So I suppose in Kempo Sutum Jatsu's tradition that you have received, these are seen as purpose being taught for a definitive teaching that is Buddha nature, right? Whereas a lot of the other traditions would argue that Buddha nature is a provisional teaching, or Buddha nature teachings are provisional in nature. And these are the five reasons, five purposes for which they are taught. They shouldn't be taken as absolute definitive teachings. How do you see that?
Well, actually, in Kongtrul's commentary, he does quote Mikyo Dorje. And Mikyo Dorje, he also says, yeah, there are some who says this is, you know, provisional teachings because they stated a purpose. But then he also says, but if these 5 points, then there would be no need to call them false, because there wouldn't be five faults. There would be nothing wrong with low self-esteem, because there wouldn't be a Buddha nature. There would be nothing wrong with not respecting others, because they wouldn't have a Buddha nature. There would be nothing wrong with, you know, taking the disturbing emotions to be real, because maybe they would be real. And there would be nothing wrong with not understanding the true nature of the mind, because it wouldn't be the true nature of the mind. And there would be nothing wrong with inflated sense of self, because, you know, others wouldn't be Buddhas, like, you know. And so he's saying they fall by calling them faults, because then they wouldn't be faults.
Yeah.
So he's saying that there's some, you know, and actually I thought about it myself, this, you know, because I know the polemics are very rampant, but I thought, is there anything wrong with an ultimate teaching that is really true, which also helps you overcome your temporary problems? I mean, does it have to be a contradiction? What do you think?
Well, I mean, to me, just like your understanding, I would say that, yes, the teachings can be definitive and at the same time address the problems we have. But for those who don't accept this to be definitive teachings, these purposes become a very good tool to argue that, you know, they're provisional, taught with a purpose. But what I want to add here is, interestingly, Asanga himself, in his commentary, brings up again a different question. And the question relates to the preceding verses, basically saying, if Buddha nature is so difficult to fathom, difficult to understand, only those who are on stages can fathom it, why teach it to the ordinary people right now? And then he says, no, these are being taught for the ordinary people, even if they can't fully understand it, for these five reasons. So it's again a quite interesting sort of explanation or hermeneutics. And I want to go even back further than the ultimate continuum on Buddha nature. And you have worked recently on one of the most important sutras that's considered as a Buddha nature sutra, or Tathagata Garbha Sutra, Sutra of Great Compassion. You have just finished translating that for 84,000, I hear. So can you tell us a bit about that? Because that sutra is cited right at the beginning of the ultimate continuum.
Right. Yes. If you don't mind, I would like to also, on the topic of sutras, if I could mention this first, Marcus has been so kind to upload a handout on the you know, the 9 examples from the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, it is illustrations of the 9 examples. And I just thought I would mention what it is so that people can, you know, copy it if they like or whatever, have it. So this is, of course, a very important source for the Uttara Tantra Shastra. The whole section on the 9 examples are basically extrapolated from the Tathagatagarbha Sutra. And then also we have as an important source, at least in my mind, of the Uttara Tantra Shastra is the, you know, the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Gandavyuha section of the Avatamsaka Sutra, where, you know, we have the very important verses that are actually taken from there on how, you know, the Buddha's jhana is embedded in all sentient beings and they are pervaded by the wisdom of the Buddha. This also came up in your conversation with the Zen master you had here, which I found very interesting. So this is on the topic of sutras, that I find very interesting the image of how a whole universe is you know, if folded into a tiny atom. And this is the image for how all the Buddha qualities are embedded in the Buddha nature of sentient beings, and they, you know, just can't really they have to kind of break open this to experience the benefits of having the Buddha nature. And I thought it's kind of like a zip file that you get a zip file and it contains all the most wonderful things, but if you can't open it, you know, you cannot benefit from it. And so you need the software or the app to can open that particular file. And as I said before, the Rangrik is supposed to be that which, you know, for us to be able to experience our Buddha nature. So that was just a little comment on what some reflections I had on that image. But then we're coming to the Dharanisvara Raja Sutra that you mentioned. And yes, when the 84,000, which is a fantastic project, you know, making our sutra available in English, when they, you know, advertised that this sutra, they were looking for people to translate it, then I thought, oh, this is a great opportunity for me to get into what is behind here, the you know, the source listed as a source for the Uttara Tantra Shastra. And what had happened is it turned out to describe how to purify the Buddha nature more than being really descriptions of the Buddha nature itself. So the sections that explicitly, or that, yeah, this is actually not explicit, it's implicitly deal with the nature of mind, you know, the kam. These are what is called the Bodhisattva ornaments. There's 4, you know, Bodhisattva ornaments, there's 8 Bodhisattva illuminations, there's 16 kinds of Bodhisattva compassion, and there's 32 kinds of Bodhisattva activities. And this is really all those qualities and functions are ways of purifying the Buddha nature. So this is really what I found in the translation of the text, was that these are, you know, purification, ways of purifying the Buddha nature.
And that sutra is already published now in...
Yes, it's available in the reading room, yes. And as you all may know, that the 7 Vata points of the Buddha nature, of the Uttara Tantra Shastra, they say it is based on this text. And it is based on the text, but in not in a very explicit way. So the introductory chapter has the, you know, Buddha Dharma Sangha as a way of paying homage. And then what I mentioned is all about how to purify the Buddha nature. And then, of course, the text also has sections on that which corresponds to enlightenment. And then the qualities and the activities are basically actually combined in that text. So, you know, you have in the Dharani Isvara Raja Sutra, the point of enlightenment is described through the 16 kinds of compassion of awakening, and the actions and the qualities of a Buddha, the 10 powers of knowledge, the 4 assurances, and the 18 distinct qualities. These are all described. And then the sutra also contains a long list of dharanis. So, you know, you have this doctrinal context is, of course, as in all sutras, embedded in a supernatural setting. And what I find fascinating about the, you know, what we now see in all these translations is that the sutras are truly miraculous in their settings. You know, it's not like, we may have had a tendency to think that, okay, tantric literature is really very fantastic and flowery and miraculous, but sutra material is no less so, you know, it's really fantastic material. And I'm not sure that it was really studied that much in Tibet. It seems that the Tibetan tradition was more relying on Shastra literature. We're very happy that it was preserved in Tibetan language. Sorry.
No, not at all. I fully agree with you. The kind of grand cosmological settings that go ahead of most of these sutras, especially the Buddha Nature Sutras, is quite fascinating. The kind of ideas people had at that time when these sutras were coming out. just a small clarification for the audience. I think when we talk about Tathagatagarbha Sutras, there is one specific sutra called the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, and that's what Anne was referring to with regard to the 9 analogies. And then we have this group of sutras. They are often called in Tibetan as Deshikning Potempe Do, sometimes 10, sometimes more. So again, we use sometimes the term Tathagatagarbha Sutras loosely to refer to all of the sutras. Let's break at this point and see if there are any questions from our audience who are participating from different parts of the world. Marcus, do you have any questions that you received?
There are not so many questions at the moment. Maybe people will start typing them in the Q&A option at the bottom of their screens. There was one simple question, was just asking what the title that you mentioned earlier, from the third Dodrup Chen Rinpoche, that was earlier in the beginning of the discussion, asking what that actually was, which text was mentioned. Not sure if you remember what that was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is about turning heart into the path. Yeah. So the title of that text.
Yeah, it exists in a English translation. I think Alan Wallace has translated it, and also I think there are other translations of it. It's an extremely important, I find extremely important text. It's really something that can help us, at this time, because there's so much hardship that people are experiencing. There's so much suffering in the world, and as a practitioner, I came to think about, how these days many people are interested in, people who live a sort of a kind of a comfortable life during the week, and then they like to go and do extreme sports. Or there's many people have this urge to go out and do really hard things. It's a way of feeling alive, and I thought as practitioners, we don't really have to invent difficult situations, or we can just use the suffering that's already there. There's plenty of suffering that we can use as the raw material for transforming both for ourselves and others. So I thought if you can look at it as a sort of a a conscious decision that you know you're going to deal with suffering in this way, in a very, you know, take it really as a, what shall I say, you can call it an extreme sport perhaps, but yes, the transformation of suffering is so crucial. I would like to cite Milarepa on this. There's a yogi song by, you know, Milarepa, translated by Jim Scott, where he says, "The suffering being bliss feels so good that feeling bad feels good."
That's a good and one. This is
when you are feeling down and depressed, it's very useful to sing these yogic songs of realizations, where they really, you know, remind ourselves that extra layer of aversion towards suffering or discomfort, it really makes the suffering much worse.
Yeah, I think a lot of these Mengang instructions come with some segment of turning suffering, particularly illness, into a path. So, but I remember you in Mipham's writings, if that's of use for the audience. And recently I also saw a short section of this nature in Kempo Gangshar's Dzogchen instructions. So I guess, and especially when you are dealing with something that's very direct and piercing, like illness and pain.
Yes.
Any other questions? I don't think there is a question about Tanka.
Yes, behind Anne. Okay. Oh, here comes another question though. Thank you for your clarity and lovely presentation. The first Tibetan text that I read was also the Jewel Ornament of Liberation in English. And the expression, "Who is suffering all beings in the six realms," opened my mind in 1967.
Wonderful, thank you. Yeah.
Are there any other questions coming in?
Any. Okay, so while we wait for other questions, we were almost 1 hour anyway, but you have done a tremendous amount of work on Buddha nature and the ultimate continuum. You've done a list of the commentaries, Tibetan commentaries on the ultimate continuum, Chilama. I can't remember how many exactly you found this recorded, not perhaps extant right now, but recorded to have been composed.
Yes. After, about 20 years of, receiving oral instructions, then I started in the academic world. And of course, what I found interesting as my subject was to search for texts that related to, because I found out the interpretation were so different in the different schools. So I really wanted to find out about them. So I started to, search for texts. And in those days, it wasn't so easy as it is today, wonderful to see now how things have been preserved digitally in your own library in Thimphu, for example. A lot of texts are there that we were very happy to, that were preserved, for example, in Bhutan, the Shakya Chokten's volumes were preserved in Bhutan, which is such a gift. And we saw this wonderful presentation by Yaroslav the other day, who's really our main Sakya Chokten scholar. So yes, when I found a commentary on the Dalai Lama by Sakya Chokten, I was really happy. And many other commentaries that, I haven't, of course, been able to look at them. But at the time that I finished the list, there was about 50. But this is 20 years ago, so now there will be more, because I know that the Kadamba texts were found and things were returned from China. And of course, in Lhasa, the library was just, it wasn't possible to get into the, they had huge amounts of text that were just locked away. And I think and hope that slowly whatever is there will be recorded, so we will find out how many more there might be. But yes, as I said, about 50 at the time. And of course, what I found was interesting was that they were classified in you know, the Jude Lama commentaries were classified in basically any category you might think of. Then there was the Jude Lama commentary. If Madhyamika, then Jude Lama was there. If it was Chittamatra category, Jude Lama was there. As Shentong text, it was there, you know. So it kind of defies categorizing. It was like difficult to pin down where shall we place this text.
Yeah, we have commentators who interpret Jude Lama in all these different traditions. Any other questions? If there are no other questions, I want to ask you perhaps my final question then. You have done a lot of study, and earlier you mentioned about how you encountered the Buddha nature teachings yourself. And one of the things I was wondering is, in those days, it must have been so difficult to access these teachings, because I don't know how many translators existed then. And that's what drove you to also take up Tibetan. But today we are perhaps actually far, far better off in terms of the availability of interpreters and translators, English speaking teachers, not only just Tibetans and Himalayan teachers, but also a lot of now Western teachers teaching in secondary languages. There's also awful amount of literature available out there, both digitally and in print. So if someone is now encountering the Buddha nature teachings, what would be your advice for them to actually navigate through these huge sort of inundation of information and dharma available to make the path more effective, more, say, focused?
Yeah, it's a good question, Karma, because these days we have so much information available. And my advice is that, you know, if you have the opportunity to meet a master or you have connection to a master, you should go and spend as much time as you can there, because the transmission lineages, you know, is very important to keep them alive. And so not just to rely on books, but really seek out individuals who you know, have a level of realization of the Buddha nature, who can transmit the present of, you know, the presence of being centered in the Buddha nature is a very important, because information is just information, but experience and true, what's the word I'm looking for, the somebody who's living the Buddha nature. This is extremely, for me, it has been extremely important, more than anything else. And then what I would like to suggest is, avail yourself of these wonderful resources. For example, a good place to start, I would think, is the Tatra Buddha Nature website, where you're really gathering things and you have, you know, you're showing people who have been working with things, and you're linking to their publications. So you may go with some of that. And then of course, this way of, you know, people get to meet people in this way, they can connect through, maybe if they find somebody is inspiring, they can, you know, follow up on that. Or again, we mentioned the 84,000 website, sutras are there, they're available. It's very good to actually recite sutras or read them aloud. It has very important, I find a very useful way of recitation meditation is very important, in your own language also, as a way of connecting with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas through the sutra material. Also, I would like to mention, if anybody is interested in the teachings of Kenpo Tsultum Gyamsa Rinpoche, there's now also a very nice website on the digital library of Kenpo Rinpoche's teachings. They are there, you know, in audio and video. And there's also the yogi songs that I mentioned that you can listen to, or you can sing, and you can, if you like, to practice through, you know, emulating realized masters. A very good way to do that is through singing songs of realization. It can really cheer you up because the meaning is so profound, and singing it itself is something that can, you know, be uplifting.
Well, wonderful. Those are just wonderful recommendations, especially singing yogic songs, I think. Yes. It can be very therapeutic and at the same time, perhaps quite enlightening. If there are no questions, then we may perhaps draw this session to an end. Thank you, Anne, for sharing your knowledge and wisdom and experience with us. And thanks everyone else joining us from around the world. Do keep interested in this series of conversations, and we hope that through today's session, you'll be able to overcome the five problems that Maitreya mentions, and then cultivate the five positive attitudes, five positive sort of aspects of, let me count them, of great joy or enthusiasm, of respect for others, like respecting a Buddha, of not giving in or falling for unreal, untrue, affective emotions and things, and going for wisdom, going for truth through wisdom rather, and through, as a result, cultivating great love, great loving kindness for all sentient beings. So with that, thank you everyone, and have a wonderful holiday season. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Thank you.